Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Michael Ian Black is a comedian, actor, and author whose first major credit was as part of The State, a comedy troupe founded at NYU, which had a popular television series on MTV from 1993 to 1995. After The State, he co-created and starred in Viva Variety, a fake European variety show, that's fake European, real variety, on Comedy Central. He played Phil Stubbs on the NBC series Ed.
Okay, Phil. I'm all yours.
Just tell me why you should be the new manager of Stucky Bowl.
Good question, my man, but don't ask me. Ask the people who count. The customers. Cue lights!
And was a frequent talking head on VH1's I Love the Blank Decade series. Here he is on I Love the 80s talking about Wheel of Fortune.
It was not Wheel of Fortune. It was simply the wheel. 7:30, time for the wheel. You can tell that Pat Sajak kind of hates himself on Wheel of Fortune.
All right, we're back. I'm wearing a microphone. I don't have to shout.
Sort of like, hey, welcome to Wheel of Fortune. I'm still doing this. Here I am.
Yeah.
Let's meet our contestants. How you doing?
And I'm working in my first novel.
Yes, I am.
Got an interesting life in the military. I'm still doing this.
Michael Ian Black's new book is entitled You're Not Doing It Right, Tales of Marriage, Sex, Death, and Other Humiliations. He's written screenplays for movies Wedding Days and Run, Fat Boy, Run. His previous book is entitled My Custom Van and 50 Other Mind-Blowing Essays That Will Blow Your Mind All Over Your Face. Michael Ian Black joins us now. Michael, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
What made you want to write this book, You're Not Doing It Right?
I think it was a combination of having my version of a midlife crisis and wanting to expand my creative self,
mm-hmm.
And also wanting to become a better writer. I had no deep desire to reveal myself, but I needed to write about the things that were important to me, and the things that are important to me in this moment are being a husband and being a father. So that's what I wrote about.
Are there any stories in the final version of the book that you considered leaving out after reading them over once? Like, oh, that's too honest. I don't want people to know about that.
No. If anything, the stuff that was probably the most revealing and the most honest and the most deeply personal were the things that I knew I was going to put in.
Mm-hmm.
Things that were maybe sort of smaller in terms of actual event. Were the things that I was most worried about. Like, I have a long chapter about buying a car.
Right.
And how conflicted I felt about buying this expensive car. And that was one of the chapters that I considered leaving out just because it didn't feel momentous enough.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I knew I had something to say about that, I wasn't sure that it was enough. And to my relief, several readers have pointed to that chapter as one of their favorites.
The book is, as we've already sort of said, startlingly honest in regards to what marriage is really like. It's obvious that you love your wife very much, Martha, but that sometimes, you know, living with somebody and seeing them every day is very aggravating, and you're incredibly honest about it. What does Martha think of the book?
She likes it, and it surprised me that she was as gracious about it as she's been.
Mm-hmm.
She had deep reservations about me writing the book, for obvious reasons.
Sure.
And has been so accommodating about it. I think when she read it, she felt like it told my story, but my story wasn't necessarily her story.
Mm-hmm.
And so she said that she ended up feeling more like a character in a book, as opposed to, she didn't feel violated personally. You know what I mean? She didn't feel like she had been exposed. And I think she comes off pretty good in the book.
Yeah.
I mean, I come off far worse than she does. Not that I pull any punches on her. I mean, I call her terrible names in the book.
Right. Well, you both come off like, you know, full-fledged humans, not characters.
Well, that's what was important to me in terms of writing about marriage and in writing about fatherhood. I feel like there's a tendency, particularly from male writers, to write these kind of treacly love letters to their wives and paint themselves in unflattering portraits, but they're not necessarily honest about the shortcomings of their partners. The reasons to do that are obvious, which is that you don't want to hurt people you love, and I struggled with that too. But I felt like I needed to write something that accurately reflected the challenges that both of us face as we hurdle through life together. And now it's been 13 years, and you know, every day is a new challenge. You know, we have great moments of happiness and great moments of utter frustration and disgust with each other.
Are you at all concerned that at some point in the future your kids will read the book and it will hurt their feelings?
I don't think it will. I mean, I think they know me well enough to know that my relationship with their mother is deep mm-hmm. and committed and important. And the horrible things that I say about them in the book, I say to them to their face. So.
Right. Do you hope that this book replaces Bill Cosby's family parenting book on people's shelves?
It had never occurred to me that it might. But now that you mention it, absolutely. I absolutely hope people just burn their Bill Cosby books and replace them with mine.
How was writing this book? I mean, obviously the subject matter is very different. The style is pretty different. It's your voice, which we're familiar with from hearing you speak on television programs over the years. But how is this book different for you from My Custom Van?
Well, My Custom Van was a series of absurd essays, just one silly essay after another, 50 of them packed into a book. And I really like that book. I'm really proud of the book. I think it's a really fun book and a really mm-hmm. funny book. But there was nothing personal about it. There was nothing revealing about it. There was very little of me, the actual me, in the book. So when I sat down to write this book, I knew I wanted to do that. I knew I wanted to write about myself, and I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know how to even approach writing about my own life in an honest way. And it took over a year of fits and starts to even begin to start really writing the book. It was very, very difficult. Very difficult to understand just the craft of how to write about myself in an honest way that was hopefully also compelling.
Did you talk to anybody about it, or did you find the way to do it on your own?
I found it on my own. I didn't. I suppose I would have, but I didn't. I don't really have writer friends.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't occur to me to even seek out that kind of guidance. And the process of going through those difficulties, the process of stumbling and falling time after time after time, I think was actually very good for me and taught me a tremendous amount. And that was important to me. It was important to me to teach myself how to write with this book. And I think I did. I mean, you know, I'm no master, but I feel like I took a big step forward in my own education as a writer.
You also have written kids' books, Chicken Cheeks and a Pig Parade is a Terrible Idea. What do you like about writing books for kids?
The money. Primarily the money. Well, when you have kids, it's like, you know, my occupation is so sort of strange to them. I mean, they're 8 and 11 now, so they kind of understand what I do. But when they were younger in particular, they didn't really understand what I did for a living. And I felt like writing kids' books was something that I could kind of give them to illustrate that dad is just not a knockabout who sometimes turns up on the television. Like, mm-hmm. dad actually does stuff. So it was more a gift to them than anything else.
When you are recognized on the street or in a cafe or wherever you might be recognized, what are you most often recognized for?
Oftentimes for things that I wasn't even in. The thing that I've probably been recognized most for is being in the sketch comedy troupe, The Kids in the Hall.
Oh, right. And
you're not. Which I was not in. But I get recognized for being in it all the time. It's always been a little bit unclear to me why that happens, but it does. Other than that, you know, a kind of panoply of things, any number of my short-lived television series. Lately, I've been recognized as the Expedia guy because I have an Expedia commercial that's been running a lot. So it's sort of like whatever is in the popular consciousness at that moment is what people see and recognize me for.
Our guest is Michael Ian Black. His new book is You're Not Doing It Right, Tales of Marriage, Sex, Death, and Other Humiliations.
A friend of mine will be embarrassed that I'm asking you this, but she did specifically want to know what you enjoyed about, or if you remember fondly, playing Johnny Blue Jeans on Viva Variety.
Oh, sure. That was the second television show that I co-created. It came after The State. And we did about 40 episodes of it. It was for Comedy Central. And the premise was, we're making a fake European variety show.
Mm-hmm.
And I played the co-host, or the sidekick, I guess, Johnny Blue Jeans, who was this very enthusiastic Americophile, I guess would be the word.
Sure.
Who just loved all things American and wanted to be American in the worst way and just failed spectacularly at being American. And he wore these tight pleather outfits and had a big bouffant hairdo and sort of worshipped Fonzie. And it was a character that I actually kind of loved playing because he was so pleasingly dumb.
Right.
And there's nothing more fun to play than just sort of a pleasant idiot.
Speaking of maybe the opposite of that, I listened to Marc Maron's podcast. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, heard you on it and wanted to ask you if that was as uncomfortable as it seemed, or if you did sort of know what you might be getting into when you sat down to talk with Mark.
I'm not feeling that right now. Do you want some tension?
No. I wanted to come into this with as few expectations as possible and with no defensiveness on my part.
Really?
Yes. That was my intention.
Is that what I was feeling when you got to the door? Because you came right in and you're like, all right, this is where I'm at. That was you being open.
Trying to be.
Okay.
Trying to be.
What are you doing in town?
Shooting a commercial.
Well, Marc Maron, as your listeners probably know, mm-hmm. has a very successful podcast called WTF, in which Marc Maron, angry comedian, interviews other comedians. And with Marc, I've known him for 20 years. Our relationship has always been fraught with tension due to rivalry, mm-hmm. I guess. And so when I sat down with him, and I'm a great admirer of him and the podcast.
Yeah.
So I was actually thrilled to be a part of it. And I thought, well, we'll have a pleasant conversation. Clearly, we're over our rivalry. Clearly, we'll just sit down and he'll ask me questions and we'll have a pleasant conversation. And no matter what, I am not going to get defensive and I'm not going to get my hackles up. Within about 30 seconds of me sitting down and him turning on the microphones, we're kind of arguing with each other because he is being, so he's just being aggressive.
Yeah, he is. I mean, he'll admit it.
He's just making fun of me and mocking
disparaging
me.
Disparaging your work, right?
Oh, God, he's the worst. I love him, but he's the worst person alive.
No, it's I listen to it regularly, and sometimes I just like, why am I listening to this? Why am I listening? Because it's great. It is great. But
it's compelling radio. It really is. I mean, listening to him deal with his own anxieties and neuroses and professional entanglements is really compelling. It's not that much fun to be on the receiving end of it,
but
I love listening to it.
Yeah, you learn a lot about the guests and more than you ever wanted to know about Marc Maron. I hope he doesn't hear this and then podcast.
Oh, I hope he hears it. I definitely hope he hears it. I want him to start a feud with you.
Oh, I couldn't take it. I would definitely just crumble. Speaking of podcasts, you do one with your former co-star of Ed, Tom Cavanaugh, called Mike and Tom Eat Snacks. What made you want to carve out the time in your schedule to record that, to eat snacks with Tom?
It is the very opposite of Marc Maron's podcast. His is dark and brooding and introspective. Ours is light and extroverted and ridiculous. My friend Tom Cavanaugh and I, who, as you said, we were on the show Ed together, have remained friends throughout the years and have always sort of pined to do something together. But you know, it's very hard in show business to get any kind of project off the ground. And the rigmaroles of like pitching a television show or writing a script or doing whatever, it just takes forever. So we thought, well, what's the easiest thing we can possibly do? And we decided that would be a podcast. And then we thought, well, what's the easiest possible thing we could talk about on the podcast? And snacks immediately came to mind. So it was the first idea that we had, and we're like, oh, yeah, we'll just do that. And so each week we pick a snack, eat a snack, and rate a snack. So this current week is our 50th episode, and we rate Devil Dogs, Drake's Devil Dogs. And, you know, spoiler alert, they're not very good.
So you know what happens at the end, but still you should listen and see how Tom and Micah get there.
Well, the thing about the podcast that I think makes it work and makes it fun is that, yes, it's about snacks, but of course it's nothing about snacks.
Right.
I mean, the snacks is a skeleton that we hang our conversation off of. And each week it's just a half an hour of us just goofing around and just exchanging banter and fooling around and having fun. And the show is a really good reflection of our actual relationship. I mean, we don't plan anything. We don't script anything. We just, you know, we just sit down and turn on the microphones and have a great time.
You mentioned, you alluded to before, your being on many failed television series or canceled television series. And I was bummed, as I'm sure you were, that your relatively recent Michael and Michael Have Issues didn't hit. Do you have any idea why some things work and why some things don't? Or is it always just you just hope for the best and work hard and then see what happens?
In my experience, what I've discovered is that mainstream audiences don't like what I do.
So okay.
That seems to be the reason why things don't hit.
So
for whatever
fault.
Reason,
okay.
My sensibility does not mesh well with the sensibility of America. And so it's always heartbreaking when I relearn that lesson, but I seem to relearn it just about once a year. Once a year, something comes along that I put my pour my heart and soul into, put it out there, and it is roundly ignored. I suspect the same thing will happen with this book.
What are you working on next?
Another book, actually. I have another book that I'm writing with Meghan McCain, who is a Republican pundit and daughter of Senator John McCain. We took a road trip this summer where we traveled the country, West Coast to East Coast, and we chronicle that adventure in a book.
How did you meet her and decide to work on that?
I had met her very, very briefly, over satellite, actually, when I was doing a pilot for E! Entertainment Television. And she was a guest on the pilot, and we sort of chatted and kind of hit it off. And then a few weeks later, I took an Ambien and got on Twitter, which is not a good combination if you wanna keep your wits about you.
Or is it the best combination?
In this case, it turned out to be the best because I tweeted her and said, "Hey, we should write a book together." And she of course didn't realize that I was on Ambien, and she's like, "Yeah, sure, why not?" And then we started emailing back and forth for a few weeks to try to discern what the book would be about, and we did and went out and sold it, and now I'm rewriting chapters not as we speak, but right before I called you, I was rewriting chapters.
I know that you are being asked about this unceasingly, but would you mind giving us a wet hot update?
The answer is I don't know.
Yeah, okay.
Sorry. I think maybe, but I don't know. You can ask the question if you want.
No, that's okay. Just Wet Hot American Summer. Something?
Well, my friend, Wet Hot American Summer is a movie that I was in 10 years ago, and it's become a kind of cult classic. My friends, Michael Showalter and David Wayne, who also are two-thirds of my comedy trio, Stella, mm-hmm. and two-elevenths of my comedy troupe, The State, wrote the script, the original script, and David directed it, and Michael started it, and I was fortunate enough to be in it. And so there have been rumors swirling about a sequel because Michael Showalter went on Bravo TV and said, "Yes, there's definitely a sequel happening."
Right.
Like an idiot, when there is no firm commitment from anybody to make a sequel to the film. So I know that they're working on a script. I know that much of the cast has said, "Whenever you do it, I want to be a part of it." But that's as far as it's gotten to this point, as far as I know.
Speaking of David Wayne, I saw Wanderlust last night, enjoyed it, and your cameo in it very much. The end.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me. Good luck with the book. I loved it.
Thank you, Sarah. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. And have a great day.
You too. Take care.
Michael Ian Black's book, You're Not Doing It Right, Tales of Marriage, Sex, Death, and Other Humiliations, is available now. It is published by Gallery Books. His website is michaelianblack.net. I'm Sarah LaDuke, and you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. To wrap up, here's a clip of Michael Ian Black, Michael Showalter, and David Wayne from Stella, live in Boston.
Guys, before we go too far, we do have to tell you about some of the rules tonight.
This is important.
The so theater important. Here has asked us to lay just 10 rules that if you follow
and
it...
This is
not part of the show.
This is not a joke, this part.
So basically...
What?
This is... No, guys, seriously.
Like...
We just got to get through this. Rule number one, no smoking.
That's
you cannot
really,
smoke here.
Really, really important.
If you have... You got to put it out.
Yeah. Rule number two, smoke them if you got them.
Rule number three, you guys, and this is for everybody, but it's mostly for the gymnasts in the crowd. Stick the landing.
Yeah.
You gotta do
so
it.
True.